Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
Is your vehicle stopping like it should? Does it squeal or grind when you brake? Don't miss out on summer brake deals at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Ready to experience the Gnostic Sophia in a deeper reality never felt before? Find the truth about the divine feminine in Gnostic tradition, ancient and modern, and how to reverse Sophia's rebellion that created this coded reality ruled by Archons. Is Sophia a Gnostic goddess, fallen angel, the Holy Spirit, mother of demons, alien scientist, Gaia, or Mary Magdalene? Find out August 9th and 10th for 2 days of immersive and mystic experience at Astrognosis, Sophia in Simulated Realities. Expert speakers will address the manifestations of Sophia and the nature of reality itself. Astrognosis 3 includes interactive workshops, meditations, vendors, and social events at the Theosophical Society, Wheaton, Illinois. Don't miss this unique opportunity to learn, connect, and grow with fellow seekers. Come listen and interact with Maja Daou, Mitch Horowitz, Chris Knowles, Richard Smoley, Ola Wolny, James True, Dan Morris, Diana Kelly, Steven Snyder, and more from Aeon Bite. Sponsorship opportunities available. Theosophical Society, Wheaton, Illinois, August 9th and 10th. Tickets at thegodabovegod.com or Eventbrite. See you there.
Happy heresies and welcome to the Desert of the Real. And yes, a little promo for Astrognosis. I hope to see you there. The tickets are selling well. And a little news that online tickets are available. So if you can't make it, you can stream it from any device. You can re-watch it. You can ask questions. And you'll get more than 12 hours of really amazing, unique content that you won't find anywhere else. And this includes panels. Even if you're streaming online, we'll have some rituals that you'll be able to, again, interact and watch online. So check it out, Astrognosis. And yes, my name is Miguel Connor. I am your pompous of Gnosis. I am struggling with the cold, but the show must go on. And please forgive my voice and any sort of random coughing here and there, but so it is. But this is definitely a show I would not miss or change, because it is a book that I really enjoyed, and a book that really, in a holistic way, tackles a lot of the high weirdness that includes what we've dealt with on Aeon Bite, and comes to some unique conclusions. So for this, very excited to have Keith Thompson to discuss his book, The UFO Paradox. Keith, thanks for coming on.
Well, Miguel, it's great to be here. Thanks for that introduction. And also thanks for the introduction to your show. What a beautiful promo for the conference. Very, very provocative imagery that I'm just, it's a great way to start a conversation with that kind of expansive space. It takes conversation is lucky if you can get to that kind of expansive space. So now we're starting with that. I'm a little nervous about it. If that's the baseline, boy, where might we go?
Yeah, it's all a simulation anyway, so we'll see what the code has to say. We can go back and change the code. We're learning, you know, the future can affect the past, and yeah, time is not linear and things can change at a moment. So that's what we do here in the Desert of the Real. And with us too, we've got the Moondog Vance. Vance, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Talk about paradoxes. The government doesn't seem to be able to make its mind up about UFOs. First it's in, then it's out. So I'm sure we'll talk about that today. And there's always a mystery question about what the heck are they and how many different species are there and how do they work and all that stuff. So it's going to be a good show.
Indeed, indeed. So let's start with the beginning, Keith. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in the UFO phenomenon. I think it started, what, sixth grade, and you giving a presentation on UFOs, or when did it start?
It started exactly that way. I was 12 years old in sixth grade. It was my turn to give a current events report in class, which is one of the best rituals. I recommend anybody who's a school teacher, get your students to do that. You turn them into little reporters, where their job is to tell a story of something going on in the news. It happened, I was living in Northwest Ohio. That's where I grew up, just south of Michigan. And in Michigan at that time, there was a major UFO sighting that went on for 3 or 4 days. Colors, lights in the sky, strange objects that appeared to be craft, and near a college called Hillsdale. And so I said, okay, I'm gonna choose this as my story. I began to clip articles from these objects called newspapers. Young viewers may not have ever heard of
them.
Yeah, you can't clip them off your computer screen. They used to deliver a bundle of paper to your driveway every day. So I clipped articles and watched the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. We're continuing to cover the amazing lights in the sky in Hillsdale, Michigan. We now go to Bob Schieffer, who's on the site. I grew up loving that kind of news coverage. I knew that I wanted to be part of that. So in any case, here's what happened in Hillsdale. The Air Force consultant named J. Allen Hynek, flew in as he did. He didn't really realize it at the time, but the Air Force had hired this astronomer to essentially debunk UFOs. He didn't know that. He was a scientist of integrity. He actually thought that they wanted him to come up with accurate information, and he was pretty much a straight shooter. So when he got to the area, he was driven around, and one of the spots he visited was a marsh or a swamp at the edge of the town. And he took a look at what had happened there and how it was described, the lights that were seen. So came time for him to appear before a news conference on those metal chairs in a school auditorium. And he stood up to the podium and was asked, "What's going on here, Dr. Hynek? What have you concluded?" You know, the expert coming to school the villagers about what's going on in their town. And right there is a nice scenario, right? The classic case. So he said, "Well, there are many aspects of this, but I can tell you the one sighting I think that we might be able to remove from the table. It's off to the edge of town, this marsh. I think that it's possible in that particular case. It could have, what might have been seen, could have been seen possibly, was swamp gas. A swamp gas is a natural phenomenon, a decaying of foliage in the water, and it sends off luminescence of some kind." So he stood there really mortified as the news media jumped out of their seats, ran out to the hallways, to the payphones, called their news bureaus to say, "Hynek writes it off to swamp gas." He didn't write it all off. He made a very particular statement that some of the sightings might be swamp gas. This is, by the way, a recurring dynamic in the UFO field. You know, how do you interpret the text? The text is the sighting. So I thought that was an amazing part of the story. So I told it to my class. And one, it came time for questions and answers. The students loved it. They were riveted by the story because they'd been following it too. It was really a big national story. It's when UFO stories were covered in that way. And one of the students said, okay, well, do you think they're aliens from outer space? And I said, well, I don't know. I mean, that, but that's one interpretation. And I don't, you know, that's a major interpretation. So I was getting a taste of the of how these dialogues go. Another student said, well, what do you think they saw? And I said, well, I don't know, but it certainly didn't sound like swamp gas. It didn't fit the descriptions of craft and lights and so forth. And my teacher stood up at that point. Name was Mrs. Lowry. And she said, I think what Keith is trying to say is it's important to keep an open mind and ask good critical questions about something like this. And that I begin the book with that story, Miguel, because it was one of the first times outside my own family I was really seen as a person. It was a kind of a benediction. Here was an adult teacher who was treating me like an aspiring adult who had something to contribute by showing up. And that sense of being seen was a very powerful thing for me. And then she said to me, she said, Keith, you, and she said, as the teachers often do, well, Mr. Thompson, you have the makings, I think, of being a reporter or a scientist, maybe even a detective. She said, follow the evidence where it leads, no matter what the subject. Well, she introduced me that day to the idea of empiricism. I was 12 years old. I'd never heard a fancy term like empiricism, but it had to do with observing what's observable and reporting about it and setting aside questions like what it could be or couldn't be. Like the students asked me, was it spaceships? Do you believe in aliens? I intuitively understood those were interpretations. They weren't the descriptions. And it wasn't an act of genius on my part, but because that distinction locked in for me early on, I continued to pay attention to this phenomenon and this classic dynamic of ordinary, credible, responsible people report extraordinary, incredible, magical realism type events, which, by the way, we could talk about the sense in which the UFO phenomenon is like magical realism in the genre of movies, where ordinary reality itself is punctuated with magic, and it's not considered extraordinary. In magic realism, especially the Latin American style, Borges and Garcia, Marquez, the ordinary world is suffused with magic. It's unlike the classic Western, the idea that, you know, you, for example, Harry Potter, it's all magic or it's all realism. Magic realism blends the two. That I didn't know about that genre at the time. I didn't know about that genre of literature, but I've come to realize that's a big part of what fascinated me. Ordinary people seeing extraordinary things, and then the agents of official culture show up. Science, academia, the media. No, that didn't happen. People are easily confused, madness of crowds and so forth. So we said, go home, people, go back to your lives. It's all okay. And I said, that dynamic also appealed to me. The way in which that kind of dismissal doesn't get rid of the phenomenon, it pushes it underground. And that's a big part of what I do in this book when I say it's the celestial and symbolic world of UFO. Something is seen in the sky, but because it's shoved down into the ground, from the sky underground, it becomes highly symbolic, overly charged with symbolism, more meaning than we can deal with. So anyway, that's a quick introduction. I'll just make one reference to another aspect, and we can maybe have that later. There was also some personal experiences I had with the numinous, you could say, with extraordinary, with a larger sense of reality that were quite positive in that they left me with the sense that this is the game board that we call reality is much bigger and much different from what we're taught. And I understood that in some way. So we can get into those kind of cases too. The key thing with this book, or those experiences, the key thing with this book, Miguel, is that I decided for the first time, it's not off limits to bring my own experience into my work. To the contrary, how long do you have to live before the first person pronoun is a legitimate piece of data? You got to take an objective stance toward your own experience, sure. But I had overcompensated for years writing about UFOs and anomalies. You dare not bring in your own experience because this phenomenon is already freighted with subjectivity. Oh my God, I think he's including subjectivity. Well, what do we have but subjective? We live in a world of interpretations and attempts to understand what we're doing. So anyway, I decided to bring my own experiences into the book, not only beginning the book with my sixth grade episode, but also talking about, as I say, encounters with bigger realities that have shaped my worldview. So that's a quick overview.
Well said, indeed, and agreed. And as somebody who honored your work, Jeff Kripal has said, we do need a new language. That's how we understand the world, because our language changes reality and a new way to look at reality. New paradigms is the only way out of this. The old ways are not going to work, so we need to change that. And I think somebody who has definitely wanted a new language too was Carl Jung. And I was reading his famous essay on flying saucers and then reading about how you write with Kenneth Arnold, who everybody says, well, that's where we got the flying saucer. But as you say, there was no flying saucer. He just said they skip on the water like a flying saucer. But Jung, when talking about the flying saucer, he mentioned that when people are having dreams of, again, flying saucers, round things, it's when they're individuating and getting to a new stage of their lives. So he made that correlation and said what was happening in the 50s is that American Western society was coming out of World War II and was coming to a new stage of our collective consciousness. So there was UFOs. UFOs are back again. And what's happening, Keith? Let's be real. The American Empire is over. We're coming to a new paradigm. So, of course, flying saucers are coming. And, of course, Jung would say, it's not in our head. This is happening outside. But, again, as you said, subjectivity. Reality is interactive. That is scientific and mathematical. And as you write, UFO encounters are sort of an initiation into something new, something cosmic. Jung will call it individuation, but we can call it initiation, right? Something is changing in reality, in culture, and within ourselves. And sorry for the little, I hope I wasn't going.
Those are all good points. I will say I decided to use the work of Joseph Campbell, who I was actually privileged to know and work with, book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. After he retired from Sarah Lawrence College, he developed a new career as giving workshops and seminars around the country at a human potential type retreat centers. And I had the remarkable privilege of taking several 5-day workshops with Joe Campbell. So I studied the hero's journey, the 3-stage model of separation, initiation, and return. Basic idea is you separate, there's an experience in life that separates the hero. The hero is just a term for the journeyer. And by the way, the journeyer, the person on the journey, is just walking down the street sometimes. They're going about their business. They're not appointed a hero. They become a hero or heroine of their own life by responding to the call. The call is a basic theme I use in the book. I decided to do this book because it finally occurred to me that the UFO is a call from the cosmos. Mm-hmm. A call from the cosmos, metaphorically speaking, the rest of the cosmos to say, hey, you in your little cosmos of materialist, physicalist thinking for 300 years, how's that working out? There's a lot of reality that you've excluded. And a premise that I develop in the book is that if after a time there are territories of existence, territories of experience that consistently appear, the UFO phenomenon, the near-death phenomenon, paranormal psychic phenomenon, which people don't understand. They'll say, Keith, why did you bring in the paranormal in your book? Isn't that entirely speculative? Speculative. I mean, the standard of research that paranormal studies have used with double blind, triple blind, quadruple blind, that the standard of excellence is far beyond most conventional research and medical. So it's been established beyond beyond question that we live in a supernatural, and Jeff Kripal's or supernatural, supernature. So in that sense, I use the hero's journey model. There are occasions when we're separated from reality as we know it. We're blessed to have such experiences, as difficult as they are. Then we're placed in a middle zone, a transitional zone. We're in the margins. You tell people what you saw and what you experienced. You deal with, like the author Whitley Strieber in his famous book, Communion, did not go well for his career after that in terms of the price he paid for being a reporter on news of the universe that it's not supposed to be told. So there's a long period in the wasteland. Jesus spent time in the deserts dealing with the demons. Okay. I mean, the 40 days and 40 nights, how much more clear does it become? And then there is the return after dealing with the adversaries and getting the help of the allies in this extraordinary supernatural world. The hero returns with a boon, B-O-O-N, a reward, some insight for the culture that stayed back. Not everybody goes on every hero's journey. So with that framework, I said, first of all, the individual experiencer of the UFO or the near-death experience and so forth, the larger universe, the Gnostic who has perceptions of reality that don't accord with what Constantine said Christianity should be. That guy's going to get in trouble. The Gnostic is going to get in trouble unless he keeps very quiet and writes little books and circulates them very, very carefully. So I saw this pattern in many of the UFO witnesses. And I also saw my own life where I had big openings. I experienced and achieved anything. The thing about a big experience or an illumination, you might have it as a result of practices you do. You know, meditation, visualization, affirmation, all the Gnostic toolkit. But the actual realization is nothing you can do to have that experience, because what you're realizing is you're experiencing reality as it always was. And you thought you had to find it and achieve it. So much of the spiritual path is sort of falsified in this sense that it's the classic, you know, the classic enlightenment experience or the recognition of what's really so is, oh, I had forgotten. This is how it actually always is, a Satori or Kensho experience in Buddhism. So anyway, I'm raving far and wide, but that three-stage initiation is relevant for the individual experiencer and also for the culture. This is where Jung was genius, the collective. The community is also going through initiations. Right. And I think the UFO, as I say, is a call from the cosmos. It's news from the universe. It's not going away. And a big, you know, I'll tell you what I believe. If after a certain amount of time, certain data present themselves, experiences are had in the UFO field, near-death experience, paranormal, et cetera, and they consistently deal with territories that don't show up on the maps of the society, at some point, the parsimonious move using Occam's razor, what's the simplest thing to check? Check the maps. If there's territory that continues to not show up on the maps, has anyone checked the maps lately? Are they up to date? No, they're not up to date. So we need maps of self and society and science that include the territory. It's actually doing real science in the best sense of the word science. You tell the truth about what's real. So I try to tell the truth about what's real in this book. And fortunately or unfortunately, it takes me rather far beyond the normal UFO frame of reference. So as part of the UFO paradox is that to explore this phenomenon with integrity, with honesty, we'll see where it goes. It will lead to parallels with near death. It will lead to the shamanic frame of reference. I mean, how clear could it be, not be? So anyway, that's another sort of an overview to where we can drop down into details.
For sure. And yes, going back to what you said, yeah, growing up in Mexico and Peru and other countries, yeah, the magic realism. I miss that childhood because everything was open and reality was a lot more flexible. Yeah, and going back to Jeff Kripal, I always liked how we can't just look at the aliens, as you're saying, in a typical paradigm. Like, I don't know if you watched the movie when the day the Earth stood still, and there's Klaatu, and he's on a platform, very human platform, and the UFO has tires, and you're just thinking, well, it can't be that similar. Their technology and everything would be completely different. So that, and I don't want us to limit to our language, but if you had to say what the extraterrestrials are, would you think that perhaps the closest one would be like the John Keel valet sort of interdimensional beings? Would that be pretty much it, Keith? Or what do you, or?
Okay, well, that's great. Let me go through three stages that Jeff Kripal went through and that he identified as three stages of the UFO exploration that I had actually gone through myself. And he put it in words, as Jeff often does so well.
Yeah.
The first stage is when you start to pay attention, you're going to start to say, well, the best guess, by the way, this pertains to all those UFOs that are not mundane objects. You have to remove from the pool the misidentifications of the moon or a stop sign. Or, and it's unbelievably, we are so lost in fantasy most of the time, we don't observe the natural world around us. So there are things that get mistaken as UFOs. But you get rid of all those. The existing or the remaining, what are they? Well, the first take is step level one is it appears to be some kind of physical craft, probably a technology, hardware, nuts and bolts. If you got up close enough, you could kick the tires. You could move the landing gear. So most likely this is going to be shown to be extraterrestrial. And of course, we've got great movies to back that up. And I use that phrase, advisedly, back it up. Spielberg has had such an influence, both with Close Encounters and the E.T. Franchise, that he has shaped beautifully. By the way, you probably know the story. Jacques Vallée was an advisor to that movie.
Yeah.
Spielberg brought him in. And Jacques, in his wonderful mercurial French way, said, Stephen, this phenomenon is really much more subtle and complex than the classic ET extraterrestrial. That framework is, could you use that? But it's really much more subtle. And Spielberg actually, according to Vallée, agreed with him. He said, I've looked at the data you provided. This thing is not an easy cut and dried ET thing. But he said, I work in a town called Hollywood. My job is to make successful movies. And the subtlety you're describing, Jacques, is very deep and rich. And it's not quite where the public is. So he wanted, it was a classic mothership. I mean, I love Close Encounters. I see it once a year at least because it continues to stand out. But Vallée came along in the late 60s with a book called Passport to Magonia. And he simply looked beyond the frame of reference prior to Kenneth Arnold, 1947. And he said, well, whatever it is, it's a lot older than that. And what lo and behold, we find abductions in the fairy culture, changing out babies in the fairy culture. We find in the shamanic literature archetypes that beneath the surface differences are the same archetypes. Unusual, non-ordinary, numinous characters, beings, creatures, dwarves, gnomes, humanoids interact with human beings. That's the frame of reference. And the shamanic cultures with their language of upper world, middle world, lower world, the shaman is the person in the culture, the indigenous culture, who is authorized to be the mediator for the rest of the culture. Well, in the Jungian sense, are we now living in a time when people are having their own shamanic experiences, but they don't have the shamanic frame of reference to hold the imagery? And this is where Jung is so important. So do I think it's extraterrestrial? The truth is I'll put it this way. Vallée and a researcher named Eric Davis in 2002 wrote a paper, The Physics of High Strangeness. Very good paper. And they said, there exists no experimental basis yet at this time to distinguish, to know, is it ET or parallel universes? We just don't know. It's consistent with either. But there's certainly a lot of evidence. These apparent craft, I sometimes will use the phrase apparent to remind us that these are perceptions. And we know from Plato's cave, at least, perceptions are not always accurate. Everybody in that cave was convinced that what we now know were shadows were the primary reality. We now know that those were actually shadows because one of the prisoners turned his head, got up, and looked and said, oh, there's fire. There's a bonfire behind that is casting shadows on the wall. What you guys believe is reality is nothing but shadows. Well, he delivered news that wasn't entirely welcome to the mainstream. So we're dealing with that the idea of apparent craft. These are real experiences, but whether or not they're from other dimensions or outer space, it's hard to tell. I started to say they do preferentially favor water much of the time, and the Earth is 3/4 water. So is this a parallel civilization in our Earth, but part of Earth that we don't inhabit? So the idea of the origins question is filled with wonderful rabbit holes. And by the way, there could be more than one thing flying under the flag of UFOs. Yeah. There might be extraterrestrials. There might be something in the lockers and the hangers of McDonnell Douglas, as David Grush, you know, the military whistleblower, claimed. He's been told that. And my reading of that case, even though I'm not a disclosure guy, I don't emphasize the hardcore disclosure stuff. I'm more interested in the larger disclosure, the larger ontological, spiritual, Gnostic disclosure. I mean, the disclosure is the events themselves. But as for the disclosure world, the idea that the government and the cover up is, you know, been in place, but it's about to break open. Grush, I think, is a sincere observer. He's a fair-minded observer, but what he's been told, the levels of disinformation in this world are so enormous because of the military involvement. So I don't know whether it's extraterrestrial, and I don't find the origins question. I'm less interested in that than the way it behaves and the impact it has on our psyche. It's as if a symbolic phenomenon or a phenomenon is having a symbolic impact on our belief systems. And that's a harder one to track. It's not as sexy to say something is having an effect on our symbolic belief system and shaping our beliefs. We like to think our beliefs aren't shaped. We perceive reality directly. Well, good luck with that. We're all in multiple levels of illusion and appearance all the time. And I know there's disinformation, but reality itself, we mentioned earlier the conference in Wheaton, Illinois. I mean, you know, if you've noticed the frequency with which on Twitter and or now called X and other conversations in the culture, do we live in a simulation, is actually entering into the language of physics right now. With different observers. Do we live in a simulation? Well, that's an interesting question. And again, it goes back to Plato's cave. He was the first one to say, yeah, we live in a simulation, but the simulation is not literally that an advanced culture has created our reality we don't know. It's that the reality that we live in, we don't know it very well. And our challenge finally is to, you know, a big part of my book near the end is to finally say, look, we have our own human capacities to explore reality that we don't use nearly to the extent our own supernormal nature. This is where I'm in a complete accord with Dr. Jeff Kripal. Supernature, supernormal capacities. For example, give me one. No frame of reference connected to the UFO phenomenon. What do we do with the placebo effect? The placebo effect, where let's take a study. I can't tell you the exact name of a particular study to test a pain medication. And there's a control group and a main experimental group, and nobody knows which one is getting the real medicine versus the dummy medicine. But they all know that somebody's getting the real stuff and somebody's not getting the real stuff. That's sort of part of the plan. Not only do those who don't get the real medicine, the dummy pill, achieve comparable results in pain management, they also experience comparable results of the side effects of the real drug, which they didn't get. So the people who got a dummy pill had recoveries from pain or whatever the condition was as significant, with significant statistically significant comparability to those who got the real medicine. They also got the side effects. So the power of mind in matter, not mind over matter, that matter contains mind. It's this distinction between mind and matter that Western dualistic science so deeply depends on. Again, the UFO phenomenon and the placebo effect, they didn't get the memo. They didn't get the memo that there's supposed to be a fundamental divide between mind and matter. Our maps say that, but our reality doesn't. So I'm in favor of sort of, you know, paradigm shifts happen. Enough anomalies get accumulated in a paradigm, and you can sort of put them out one by one for a while. They're just glitches in the model, maybe better studies, better research, but the anomalies continue to gather. I would say the near-death experience is probably one of the best for understanding the degree to which science has risen to the challenge of saying, there are too many anomalies here. The explanation that the near-death experience is nothing other than an end-of-life brain program that fires off so the person dying feels comforted doesn't hold up. When you have non-local communications, which I myself experienced, I decided I wouldn't talk about it for a while. But I had a near-death experience of my own, but I'm not just a sample of one here. The best near-death researchers now are the medical people who attended patients and who listened to their patients tell stories like, oh, I already know my diagnosis, doctor. I heard you talking with the other doctor in the other wing of the hospital 2 days ago when I was in a coma. And by the way, I saw you spilled mustard on the tie that day. And did you get the mustard out? And also on the roof, in the adjacent building, there's a tennis shoe on the top of the roof. How did the person know? They went out of their body during the surgery. They saw non-local. They heard non-local communications. So finally, it's the doctors themselves who heard story after story. The doctor at the University of Virginia Division of Perceptual Studies, I'm missing his name right now, and wrote a book called After. Bruce Grayson, one of the best researchers who started out as a skeptic on the near-death thing, and he's become one of the leading chroniclers of the data. So that goes to the question of anomalies. Anomalies continue to gather. And finally, a paradigm sort of needs to accommodate those. After trying to reject the anomalies, put the anomalies down, take them out of finally, the anomalies are included. And science proceeds one funeral at a time. The old order die off, and the younger scientists, who frankly have probably gone to meditation retreats, they've had psychedelic experiences, they kind of know there's a world of consciousness themselves, they start to become the researchers. They start to find scientific methods that can accommodate these data. So ultimately, I'm an optimist around those kind of dynamics.
Indeed, yeah. And for
have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of 5-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to BadlandsRanch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to BadlandsRanch.com/save50 today.
You want the best for your child. K-12 can help them gain the skills they need to reach their full potential while giving you the support you need to get them there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Their state-certified teachers make online learning interactive and engaging, allowing your child to learn at their pace from the safety of home. Join the more than 2 million families who have chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast today to learn more. That's k12.com/podcast.
For the audience, Plato's Cave, the allegory is the original Gnostic tale. Of course, the Gnostics later would say, well, okay, but we got to find out who those people casting the shadows. And then we got the archons, fallen angels, Nephilim, and all that. And people wonder, well, why does the Nag Hammadi Library have the Plato's Republic? That's got the allegory of the cave, the myth of Atlantis, all that, not Plato's totalitarian, very weird concept of the government. And yes, you do talk about your near-death experience. You mentioned Raymond Moody, Life After Life, and that's kind of a sync there, Keith, because I'm writing a spiritual biography on Elvis Presley. So he wrote his book, Elvis After Life, and people don't realize when Elvis died, it was the biggest like paranormal festival across the country. The dreams, the visions, the paranormal activity, the telekinetic stuff, and then came, of course, all the Elvis sightings that still continue today. Only Jesus and the Virgin Mary and UFOs beat Elvis when it comes to seeing people out there. So there's just something about Elvis. And of course, in my book, he had 3 or 4 UFO encounters. The king was very much on our side, Keith. He was very much into the whole UFO. He was obsessed with it, like most people are. But I'm getting on a tangent. Vance, this is a topic near and dear in your heart that you are far more experienced than I am. Questions or comments? Oh, and the audience, if you have a question for Keith, please super chat it. But Vance, tell us what's on your mind, your cosmic mind.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that pops up in my mind is the presence of UFOs around the missile bases in the United States and the whole, idea that the at least certain of the inhabitants of the UFOs, or maybe they're the beings themselves. Maybe these things are the UFO is the being that they're concerned that we're going to blow ourselves up. And what better time, what fitting time where we're further away from World War III as we are now with, you know, NATO and Ukraine and sending jets and all that stuff. It's really getting scary. And I'm a survivor in the 60s,
But who has the nuclear codes? That's what
the button.
Not that Trump is better with the nuclear codes, but Biden, that's scary.
So here we are. Hopefully, and a lot of people think this, and this is what UFOs have in common with religion. A lot of people are hoping that they'll save us from ourselves. And, that's a very common theory in religions, where people feel that these otherworldly entities are favorably looking upon us and trying to keep us from, you know, doing more damage to ourselves than we're actually capable of. So that's one thing. And the other thing I'm thinking of is the government has come out with legitimate camera footage of UFOs. The Navy in particular seems to be the most open, which is weird because, you know, you'd think the Space Force, well, you haven't heard word one from the Space Force. But here we are. The Navy is showing you, you know, actual pictures of these things that are flying around. And of course, we always have to remember Ben Rich of the Lockheed Skunk Works saying that we already had the technology to visit ET, to bring ET home and so forth. So there are people that have, you know, leaked out a little bit, but there's so much disinformation. The very fact that the government provably has issued disinformation about UFOs over the years shows you there's something to it.
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, as you know, the definition of disinformation is it's not totally false. You take kernels of truth and weave it into a tapestry of stuff you want people to be confused by. And to that's how opinion is shaped. Certainly a big part of it is. So, and then the phenomenon itself, if whatever itself is, has trickster elements, what you would call trickster elements. That's why I'm drawn to mythology. I think the reason I study mythology and have versed myself in it is not because I think it belongs on the in the folklore department, in the mythology department of the library, but because it is a very good window into human, into reality, the mythological framework. So we have Trickster, we have Coyote, we have Hermes from the Greek. I'll tell you whatever you want. Look over there. Hey, see this. Yeah. Check this out. And he'll get you laughing with him. And the trickster element is very much in full force when the debunkers are out. The debunkers, you know, the pseudo-skeptics. They're not really skeptics. They like the language of skepticism. But they generally, and by the way, there are real skeptics. I'm a real skeptic. I don't think skepticism should. I don't think skepticism should be a separate category of inquiry. If there's a magazine called Skeptical Inquirer, which there is, and I'm not here to beat up on that magazine, the Skeptics Society, the Skeptics Organization, et cetera, generally that's suspicious to me. When we have skepticism as a separate category, it means, especially when you read their websites and they say, we are committed to debunking the pseudoscience of the paranormal. Like, whoa, then let's unpack the phrase, the pseudoscience of the paranormal. You can take a pseudoscientific approach to the paranormal, but the paranormal, to investigate the paranormal, is not by definition pseudoscience. That's disinformation. That's dishonesty. It's a little bit like I describe in the book when, you know, there came a knock on the door of Galileo. And he says, yes, who is it? It's the Vatican. We've come to talk with you about these stories you're telling about the Earth orbiting the sun. You need to stop saying that. He said, you don't need to take my word for it. I have this thing called a telescope. Come look through it like I did and then test my methods the way you could. They said, we are not going to look at your telescope. Famously, we will not look through your telescope. That's debunkerism. You have Neil deGrasse Tyson, the astrophysicist, will occasionally get a guest gig on one of the big podcasts. And he'll say, you know, I don't pay much attention to the data, but it's obviously nonsense. I thought, in what other field does someone get to say something like that? I don't track the data. I pride myself on not familiarizing myself with the data, whether it's crop circles. Let's take crop circles. Obviously, that's nonsense. It must be created all by individuals. We found one that was created by individuals. Therefore, it follows that they all were. No, it doesn't. That's good disinformation. You find one factual case where guys with a couple of boards in the fields in England fake crop circles. You have other crop circles if they're not. The Occam's razor test, the principle of parsimony, does not support as the best hypothesis that they're created by humans. What are they created by? What level of energy, information, consciousness, and matter is involved? I don't know. We don't know. But it's just to simply dismiss it and debunk it. It's not real science. And we have the Galileo experiment as a permanent testimony. That's not finished. And by the way, it was the Vatican that went knocking on the door of the scientist in that case. Now we have scientists playing the Vatican, knocking on the door of trying to explain the UFO phenomenon and other stuff away. So science at its best is, you know, committed to genuine inquiry, but very often settles into nostrums, like the nostrums of physicalism and materialism, which are very good for getting to the moon, developing devices called iPhones, but they don't explain a lot of other stuff. So we need a model that includes, you know, that approach, But we've got to wrestle with the fundamental question of what is consciousness? I think that's one of the most basic factors to understand the way these sightings, the UFOs, very often a craft, an apparent craft, will show up with geometric precision on radar and other sensors, will make contact with ground, cause burn marks on witnesses, very strongly suggesting this is a material object. Then that same material object will break into two, turn into orbs of light, some of which will go into the ground, some of which will change color. And well, right there, we have a movement across a whole spectrum that would say that there's something bigger going on. And my view is, my question is, how do we accommodate that? How will we address that? How would we bring that into our system? The idea for me is eventually we've got to say, what is the nature of reality such that such events present themselves? And that's what I'm trying to account for in the book. I don't provide definitive answers, but I do draw deeply on Carl Jung, because he and the physicist Wolfgang Pauli looked very deeply into these questions, and they came up with, especially Jung, the idea of the synchronicity, those acausal, non-causal. It's a model bigger than normal causality, where billiard ball A causes billiard ball B to move, simply inertia, mass, momentum. There are non-causal connections between phenomena in this world that show that mind, consciousness, intention is very important. And fundamentally, it's causal. And with that as the framework, the UFO phenomenon gets far more interesting.
Yeah, you know, Occam's razor is not a scientific practice. Occam's razor is a tool of convenience, right? In other words, if things get too complicated, well, for example, you could explain away quantum physics by saying, oh, it's all experimental error. All the experimenters are, that's easy. That's the easiest way to get it off the table, right? Atoms are just little billiard balls that look like solar systems and so forth, which I was taught in school and, of course, is another Occam's razor product. You know, they use the shaving cream and everything, and they put the shaving cream on us, and they use Occam's razor and say atoms are just little solar systems. But of course, even at that time, you know, it was a fantasy. It was a useful fantasy, and that's really the key, isn't it? These little things, these little simplified models of reality, are useful, and especially the scientific community. And what pays the bills in the scientific community? Physical investigations, things that you can put in a laboratory. And UFOs are out in the real world. There's so many things that you know happen in the real world that you can't confined to a laboratory. People's experience, consciousness itself, you know, you just can't do it.
That's a good point about Occam's razor, by the way. Sometimes Occam is misunderstood as saying, oh, let's just go with the simplest explanation and we can get rid of all that complexity. That's not what he said. It's the simplest explanation, counting all of the data, including all the complexity. You don't want to reach conclusions based on new theories that aren't proven. But you're right. Occam's razor is a convenience, and I use it metaphorically. But yeah, you've just raised some good points.
For sure. The other thing I wanted to talk about, Keith, well, first I wanted to say, and I think you brought this up at the beginning, initiation, all that. I think people will, the UFO phenomenon or any sort of otherworldly phenomenon is a perfect chance to look inward and see what your inner world is and heal. But most people will avoid it. So I think in the UFO community, yeah, it's like we're going to avoid it because this is, like you said, this is a transformative power. This is even with Jung, when he talked about the circles and how it meant individuation, he brought Hermes too. He brought Mercury because Mercury's mandala was a circle, but he brought Mercury as, again, the trickster, but the initiator into becoming a Christ, a individuated being. So I think people, we all want to avoid, most humans want to avoid it looking inward, even if the outward world is one big mandala indicating that we should look inward, and then it gets more alarmist because we are on the brink of becoming unconscious, so more stuff happens. Doesn't mean it's all in our head, because no. This is happening outside too, as above, so below. But I don't know if you have anything to say that against. I apologize if I got into a tangent.
No, well, it's the tangents are worth following. That's generally where the meat is on the bones. I don't think right now I'll do maybe just kind of keep moving. But those are good points. I will say this, yeah. You know, you talked about Jung. I've come to really appreciate Jung more as I understand the stages of his career, which, as you probably know, he spent much of his time after his break from Freud. And when he was positing this really crazy idea at the time called the collective unconscious, he said that, you know, the unconscious is more than just a repository of the stuff that we don't want to deal with or the stuff that we forget. Yes, that exists, he said to Freud. We call that the personal unconscious, as the ego consciousness we all share, which is based on solely on rationality, binary choices like real, unreal, true, not true, happened, didn't happen, good old Aristotelian logic. Sure, that's the rational level. Then there's a personal unconscious where we deal with motivations. And with Freud, it was all sex and violence and family intrigue. But so Jung developed the idea, no, there's another level, the collective unconscious, which is highly creative. And it moves back and forth between its, and it's not only highly creative, it contains the entire history of the human condition and all of the mythological and archetypal information. So I guess my point is, when Jung proceeded to with his model to say, we've got to account for the collective unconscious, and then he tried very hard to say, but I want to be a scientist about it. I want to be an empiricist. So he continued to say, I'm not a philosopher. I'm not a metaphysician. I'll leave that to them. I'm just doing science here. Do you know, as you do know, near the end of his life, he had certain experiences, especially with the famous Red Book, which is truly a text of deep mystical Gnostic, unbelievable, and was held back for many years by who else? The Jungians, because we lose our scientific credibility if we right. Bring in the inner Jung. Well, so Jung began to say, you know, in effect, he began to acknowledge he's almost first and foremost a mystic. And he began to therefore come up with ideas like the body doesn't exist, that the consciousness does not exist in the body. The body and the material world exists in consciousness. The greater part of the soul, if you will, exists outside the body. Well, that's a very big, different angle. So the reason I identified with that is because in my own work, I had also wanted to be sort of recognized as a good empirical researcher and keeping metaphysical conclusions off to the side. And I realized they're not at odds at all. They're simply two different functions. And so to be aware of when I'm speaking more as a metaphysician versus when I'm speaking as an empiricist. There's a kind of empiricism, I favor a kind of empiricism that is truly broad and integral. I love the empirical method, but the empiricism of Western science is not adequate because it limits empiricism to only what can be conceived by the senses. That's important information, but there are levels of, we call it Gnostic empiricism, integral empiricism, synoptic empiricism, seeing many different realms, each of which have their own criteria for measuring. So we can join in a larger context, the material and the non-material. Why would we write anything off? That's what we're coming out of, this kind of binge drunk of materialism. It's just been a wild experiment in, let's say, we'll leave interiority, we'll leave the conscious world to a very narrow band with inside the human, and the rest of the world is essentially dead. Well, that hasn't worked out very well ecologically. It's turning out to enormous crisis. So these kinds of questions have deep significance, including the fact that the abductees, the people who come back from this experience called alien abduction, report interactions with aliens describing pictures of apocalypse, that our planet in burning in ruins. Now, those are like any prophetic visionary experience subject to multiple interpretations. But it's as if, as you said, Vince, there's something about the interest in these in the nuclear areas. It's definitely a pattern, and it's being ignored publicly, being ignored. But the military is very clear. They're very clear about that. They know this is going on, and we're living in a time that's quite remarkable where the UFO phenomenon has been given an acronym upgrade. It's now UAP. Let's start over. We'll call them UAP, and we'll say that some of them do exist. So actually, now it's gone from being an officially non-existent. I've been a researcher of an officially non-existent phenomenon for a long time. Now I'm a researcher and writer about a phenomenon that has marginally real. We can acknowledge that some are real, and that's where we stand right now, with the Pentagon finally coming forward with the acknowledgement of their private office of investigation. It's clear we've not gotten the full story from the military, because I think essentially the military cannot come forward and say there's something that is moving in our airspace, moving in our reality that we can't explain. It performs the following executions: speed, trajectory, right angle turns, almost instantaneous locate movement of 100 or more miles in 2 seconds.
Right.
There's something like that happening. We don't know what it is. We'll keep you posted. That's not a news conference we can expect. We can say that we can expect continuing assurance. And meanwhile, this phenomenon continues to appear in ways that should not be assuring. And by that, I mean not that we should feel threatened or worried, but we should not feel much assurance about the scientific model that just simply excludes it all from the conversation.
Yeah, but haven't we seen that, like with the Tic Tac video and the other related things, we have seen parts of, see, that's another illusion. The government, it's an entity, you know, it's a single entity. The government has all these little different tentacles, and some of these tentacles have made some disclosures, but then other parts of the tentacles tried to, you know, tamp it back. And tried to make it so that's one of the more interesting things that we've seen lately, that the government has been seen to be multifaceted, and some of the facets are honest and some of them aren't.
Well, that's exactly true. And I have a chapter in the book, which the closest I come to being a researcher on the disclosure issue was when after I wrote my book Angels and Aliens over 2 decades ago, sort of exploring the mythological comparisons of the phenomenon as having parallels in mythology and folklore. I just had to kind of romp with the phenomenon and set aside the questions of what is the reality of this. I set that aside to this book. I didn't know that there would be another book. But in any case, after having written my first book, I get a phone call. It was from the New York philanthropist Lawrence Rockefeller, who was the one member of the Rockefeller family who had metaphysical, philosophical interests. He was, in that sense, something of a black sheep. I mean, he was beloved by his family. But, oh, that's Lawrence. And what Lawrence was interested in was the convergence of East and West, interested in spirituality. So he had come up with the idea. He wanted to try to influence then President Clinton and his wife, First Lady Hillary Clinton, who had shown some interest, like many who come to the White House. I'm going to get to the bottom of this. Well, he said, let's make use of this. So he invited me, called me up. We had a great conversation. He said, I'm having a meeting at my ranch in Wyoming called the JY Ranch. I'm bringing together various researchers, including now the late professor, psychiatrist John Mack was there. And the idea was that we were going to form an initiative to the Clinton White House, an outreach to get some of this information in the public sphere. Rockefeller said, let's limit it. Start with Roswell. That way they can't, you know, instead of declassified the UFO phenomenon as a whole, he said, let's use Roswell. Long story short, an inquiry was made. One of President Clinton's associates in the White House, Dr. Gibbons, his science and technology researcher, said, we'll get on it. I'm going to ask the hardest questions I can ask. He appeared to be a genuine guy. And the response came back from those in knowledge, those in the know, who said, we've looked, we haven't found anything. Roswell was indeed consistent with a meteorological device that crashed, the weather balloon. So that was an experiment on Rockefeller's part. try to go straight to the source. And the source said, there's nothing here. Thank you very much. And interestingly, this is how the phenomenon works. Within a matter of weeks, it was disclosed that 5 years of internal documents related to Roswell had suddenly gone missing. So in the conjunction with Rockefeller's inquiry, some effort apparently got made to get rid of everything, including up to 2 years before Roswell. They were really clearing the decks. So what am I saying? Let me be clear what I'm saying and what I'm not saying. I'm not saying I know what crashed at Roswell. I'm saying with pretty close to dead certainty that it wasn't a weather balloon. The military went door to door demanding that people who had found any of the material out in the fields and had kept it would not keep it. You're not to keep this. If you keep it and don't give it back, you're going to be in real trouble. That had power at that time. That those outreaches were made is historically given. So something crashed. Was it extraterrestrial? Was it a military event of ours that went awry? Was it, as one of the researchers says, a Soviet project that made it through Alaska? And we didn't want to report on that either. It was, I don't know if we're ever going to get to the heart of Roswell, but the best guess is that the official government story, as usual, was not the full story, which therefore sends the phenomenon deeper into the unconscious, where it continues to play its way, have its way with us.
Hey, shining crazy diamonds. Please subscribe for the second part of this interview. It certainly helps grow this Red Pill cafeteria. What's more, beyond getting the second half, you get content earlier and don't have to worry about flapdoodle commercials here or on other public platforms. So please become a Red Circle sub, Patreon, or AB Prime member for the full consciousness expanding gnosis. At Patreon, I have tiers as low as $1 or $3 a month. And at Red Circle, it's a clean $4.99 a month to stream all full shows. All subs include a dedicated private stream that works on most apps. Don't forget the Gnostic Tarot, which is selling well and optimizing spiritual growth based on the feedback I've gotten, and the Virtual Alexandria Academy. I can't do it without you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.
This summer, saddle up with the only sportsbook where you can bet on horse racing, FanDuel. Right now, new customers can get a no-sweat first bet up to $500. Just download the app or go to FanDuel.com/horses to score your no-sweat bet up to $500. 21 plus and present in Ohio. Offer valid on first real money wager of $5 or more. Verified FD racing account required. Bonus issued and non-withdrawable racing site credit that expires 7 days after issuance. Max refund $500. Restrictions apply. See terms at racing.FanDuel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.